This is an Enterprise Times security podcast. My name is Ian Murphy. I'm here with Air Commodore Nick Lloyd.
Hi, I work at the Permanent Joint Headquarters in UK Defence. We're responsible for most of the British military's overseas operations around the world. We're present in 52 different locations across the Middle East, in Africa, in Asia and in Europe. My role within that, I'm the Chief Information Officer, so I'm responsible for making sure that the information that we need is flowing around those networks to support those operations.
One of the challenges that we have as a military is that we see our own world very well. But the world around us changes far faster than we can requisition equipment, retrain people and move forwards. How does that impact your understanding with cybersecurity and technology?
In normal, traditional combat capabilities around tanks, aeroplanes, ships, that sort of stuff, then a lot of the technology is driven forward by defence and by the armed forces. But when it comes to information capability, much of that is driven by the consumer market or by the commercial market. We need to be able to tap into and exploit that in the same way as, you know, commercial environments would be doing, but use it in a secure and resilient way. And you're absolutely right, it's really easy to just sit and talk to people within your own community and it ends up being a bit of an echo chamber. And really what you need to do is get out and speak to people who are dealing with similar challenges in the commercial environment to find out how they're approaching those problems so that we can see if that will prompt fresh thinking in ourselves.
How much of that is purely operational? How much of that is also about being back in base? Because if we look around at people today, everybody has a phone, irrespective of whether you're civilian or military. People have their own laptops, tablets. They want to be online talking to their families. How does that impact your ability to educate and train, but also maintain signal security?
Yeah, it's a really good question. But I'm not focused on the home base in this current job. I am focused on those overseas operations, but you're absolutely right. It's not just the issued equipment in terms of military hardware that people are using that we worry about. We have to worry about their personal security when it comes to their own devices. And so education plays a large part of that before people deploy and when they arrive in a new operational location overseas to be aware of. In the same way as if you're going somewhere that's a malarial region and you'll get briefed on what you need to be doing to protect yourself from catching malaria, people need to be briefed on what the threats are in that environment in terms of whether that's a criminal activity that you might experience or whether it's something slightly more hostile than that. And in the cyber sense, what that comes down to is people are educated on what is good and bad practice associated with their use of social media, and again, what degree of protection they should be employing on their personal devices, for example, the use of virtual private networks as a means of giving them some degree of privacy or perhaps security.
We know that they're going to be targets. As soon as they're identified online as servicemen, they're going to be targets. How do we begin to change that education, particularly in an operational theatre, to make sure they don't fall prey to things like phishing or other forms of attacks? Because people want information, irrespective of what it is, in order to track.
When it comes to their personal use, and interestingly, when people deploy, traditionally we would think about those core needs in terms of water, food, shelter, those sorts of things. We now have a saying that it's Wi-Fi before water, because that is absolutely what the current generation of people that we employ who are deploying, that's what they want access to. And we want them to access that stuff in a secure way. We will look to provide solutions for them that are appropriately secure and resilient, yet then still give them access to that rich set of information services that they're used to consuming in their home life back in the UK. Clearly, it's not always possible necessarily to give them the quality of service in terms of bandwidth they might be able to access at home, but we certainly do our best so to make sure that they can access the normal range of services in a good enough way that they can do it with minimum risk.
When we look at modern apps that people use, these things have tracking data in them. We saw with Strava earlier this year and last year where suddenly bases were being completely exposed as to structure and what people were doing. Is it possible from a military perspective now to start locking that down? Because this doesn't just become a military question, it becomes a question for any organisation in the military supply chain. It becomes a significant question for critical national infrastructure when people are moving around these bases, because they tend to expose things without necessarily realising. Are you able to find out what apps people are using, or what advice are you giving to them to think about in terms of tracking data?
Again, a really interesting question, because of course there are things that we can mandate and control on devices that we issue to people, but on their personal devices, where they're the owner, then it's much more about education. And if it comes down to protecting some of the information on there, so for example, out of our budget, we use some funding to help individuals in high-risk areas purchase VPN protection for their devices. But a lot of it comes down to good practice. So it's understanding the power of these devices, particularly in terms of geolocation, and when it is not appropriate to use those things. It shouldn't be a surprise to any military people that information, in terms of being able to establish a pattern of life can be very useful to an adversary. That's exactly what we do when we're trying to figure out what an opponent's up to. We look for patterns in their behaviour and then use that to help build our understanding of what's going on and then to help develop what we're going to do about it in terms of targeting. So it's entirely understandable that people who are hostile to us will be doing the same thing to us. It's an education piece, but it's helped by the fact that because people can see that that's how we approach problems, that other people are going to be using the same things against ourselves. Some of it is in devices where people haven't even considered perhaps the implications how they're using it because it appears so innocuous on the surface. And it can be as simple, for example, as if you don't allow mobile phones into a work area because you want to maintain the integrity of that work area, that's a positive thing. But if everybody arrives at work and they all turn their phones off at exactly the same point in a building, then that reveals something indeed about what the start work times are and the stop work times and where that control of entry might be. And that tells somebody something. Now, that information may be of interest or it may not. But the fact is, your pattern of behaviour is starting to give other people the opportunity to build a greater understanding of what you're doing.
That has an interesting implication, obviously, for a lot of civilian companies, because patterns of behavioural modifications, understanding whether something's right or wrong, understanding what's going wrong in your network, are the things they're trying to track and understand. But I'd like to come back to something you said earlier about the education. One of the challenges is upskilling people. And we know that military budget is tight. We know our personnel numbers are being cut quite heavily. How do you get enough skilled people in place? And more importantly, how do you then retain them when there's a civilian world out there offering 3, 4, 5, 6 times the salary?
That's a really good question, because we're certainly seeing that we're operating in a competitive marketplace for people who would be potentially wanting to work for us. There's effectively a national STEM crisis out there. We have a particular challenge in terms of we must retain people because, of course, we recruit people at the base rank and then we grow and develop and invest them for a full career. And if we can't retain them, the next generation might be a long way behind. So we have to focus very heavily in terms of retaining people, and we must remain competitive in terms of recruitment as well. And we work quite tightly focused on those two things in particular. Our retention actually is really remarkably positive. And I think that comes down to, it's not necessarily the financial rewards, which is the things that you alluded to. It's the fact that people go to work and they see that they're contributing something meaningful. And they can see that they're making meaningful progress towards goals that are recognisable as making the world a better place. That's quite a powerful incentive in terms of job satisfaction, the ability to do that stuff. In the recruitment space, I think what we can offer people is a vibrant environment where they're going to get responsibility and challenge and recognition for being a professional within that environment, and a career where they're going to be invested in, not just in the sense of technological skills, but also in the sense of managerial and leadership skills. And whether they decide to stay with us for a full career or not, that's a set of transferable skills that they can take away. And for a lot of people, that can actually be quite attractive, because it's a really good place to develop from, if you like, an academic set of skills to a set of skills that you can apply pretty much universally in any workplace.
When they leave, we try and keep people, obviously, in terms of a reservist position. How well is that going at the moment?
There's been a lot of effort to increase the number of reserves that are drawn upon by the military, for very good reason. What's probably maybe of interest to your audience is certainly around the cyber reserves. I have found these personally. I've used them. I've employed them. I found them really good value. It can be difficult for us to build and retain the expertise in a very narrow field, because we also need people to be generalists as well. They need to have a broader view of the context in which they're operating. And therefore, it's really difficult to be both of those things at the same time, to be both a generalist and a specialist. And so there are certain niche specializations which reservists lend themselves to very neatly, because they will have a very deep niche technical skill. And yet, if they're a reservist, we can bring them in and use them for a set period of time to apply to a particular problem that we're facing, which they will get enjoyment and professional satisfaction from, and we'll get great utility out of them. But then when we finish that, rather than have a period of downtime where they're getting bored, they can then go back to their normal day job in the commercial world.
When you're engaging with them, how many of them are willing to spend time in helping further educate their counterparts who are still serving? Is that part of that engagement, or is that something you're looking to expand?
I think that's a spin-off, to be honest. The people who are willing to be reserves in the first place, they're very positive about engaging with defence and with the single services in the military. And so just as a function of being interested in that, they're willing to share their knowledge in the same way as they also want to learn about the military aspects of being a reservist. And so they learn from the regulars around them as much as they're teaching the regulars around them. It's a really good flow of information backwards and forwards.
If we start to look forward, we're seeing a lot of pressure from government for the UK to move its stance in terms of cyber from simply being something we defend against to starting to look to be offensive against. How much additional pressure does that put on you operationally?
It's a process challenge, interestingly, because of course the military can't do these things in isolation, and Ministry of Defence certainly can't. So it's how effectively can we work with our military coalition partners at the same time as working closely with our cross Whitehall partners across government to be able to deliver combined effect of these things. If you think about states and the way states operate, where they fuse diplomatic pressure with economic pressure, a bit of military pressure, and there's obviously an information campaign running as well. When you drop down below the strategic level to the operational level, and where the military want to get a desired outcome, they also will try and fuse effects from a number of sources, whether that's physical destruction of stuff, whether that's cyber effects, whether that's building a picture of defeat in somebody's mind. You know, there's a number of things that come together in terms of overall joint effects, is the terminology that we use in this, full spectrum effects, joint effects, is where you use a number of different strands of activity to try and get the outcome that you're trying to achieve. So you can see that obviously we would be interested in this stuff, but interestingly it's the coordination of that with coalition partners and across government that's the challenge. So it's more of a process problem in terms of a challenge than anything else.
If I was to ask you to look forward 18 months, maybe as far out as 3 years, what are the big challenges that you see the services facing from a cyber perspective?
It really comes down to skills at the end of the day. Can we build the competencies and retain them and integrate them into all the other strands of activity? Because this is not going to happen in isolation. It's very unusual in conventional armed conflict to only have a conflict that occurs between armies or between navies or between air forces. Almost inevitably, what you end up with activity occurring across a number of environments, and cyber is just another one of those environments. It's the ability to build the skills up within that environment itself, and the ability to build the skills up in those other environments and operate collaboratively across all of those domains at the same time.
Ed Commodore, thank you for your time today.
Pleasure.